Anyway, Helen said, when she was capable of speaking again, I ended up talking to this woman for almost an hour. It's called victim counseling, and she does it for a living. Can you believe it? Yes, Ralph said, I can. It's a good thing, Helen. I'm going to see her again tomorrow at Woman Care. It's ironic, you know, that I should be going there. I mean, if I hadn't signed that petition... If it hadn't been the petition, it would have been something else. She sighed. Yes, I guess that might be true. Is true. Anyway, Gretchen says I can't solve Ed's problems, but I can start solving some of my own. Helen started to cry again, and then took a deep breath. I'm sorry. I've cried so much today, I never want to cry again. I told her I loved him. I felt ashamed to say it, and I'm not even sure it's true, but it feels true. I said I wanted to give him another chance. She said that meant I was committing Natalie to give him another chance, too. And that made me think of how she looked sitting there in the kitchen, with pureed spinach all over her face, screaming her head off while Ed hit me. God, I hate the way people like her drive you into a corner and won't let you out. She's trying to help, that's all. I hate that, too. I'm very confused, Ralph. Probably you didn't know that, but I am. A wan chuckle drifted down the telephone line. That's okay, Helen. It's natural for you to be confused. Just before she left, she told me about High Ridge. Right now, that sounds like just the place for me. What is it? A kind of halfway house. She kept explaining that it was a house, not a shelter, for battered women. Which is what I guess I now officially am. This time the wan chuckle sounded perilously close to a sob. I can have Nat with me if I go, and that's a major part of the attraction. Where is this place? In the country, out toward Newport, I think. Yeah, I guess I knew that. Of course he did. Ham Davenport had told him during his woman care spiel. They're involved in family counseling, spouse and child abuse cases. They run a shelter for abused women over by the Newport town line. All at once, woman care seemed to be everywhere in his life. Ed would undoubtedly have seen sinister implications in this. That Gretchen Tilbury is one hard sugar bun, Helen was saying. Just before she left, she told me it was all right for me to love Ed. It has to be all right, she said, because love doesn't come out of a faucet you can turn on and off whenever you want to. But that I had to remember my love couldn't fix him, that not even Ed's love for Natalie could fix him, and that no amount of love changed my responsibility to take care of my child. I've been lying in bed thinking about that. I think I liked lying in bed and being mad better. It was certainly easier. Yes, he said, I can see how it might be. Helen, why don't you just take your pill and let it all go for a while? I will, but first I wanted to say thanks. You know, you don't have to do that. I don't think I know any such thing, she said, and Ralph was glad to hear the flash of emotion in her voice. It meant the essential Helen Deepnow was still there. I haven't quit being mad at you, Ralph, but I'm glad you didn't listen when I told you not to call the police. It's just that I was afraid, you know? Afraid. Helen, His voice was thick, close to cracking. He cleared his throat and tried again. I just didn't want to see you hurt any more than you already were. When I saw you coming across the parking lot with blood all over your face, I was just so afraid. Don't talk about that part. Please, I'll cry if you do. And I can't stand to cry anymore. Okay. He had 1,000 questions about Ed, but this was clearly not the time to ask them. Can I come see you tomorrow? There was a short hesitation, and then Helen said, I don't think so. Not for a little while. I have a lot of thinking to do, a lot of things to sort out, and it's going to be hard. I'll be in touch, Ralph, okay? Of course, that's fine. What are you doing about the house? Candy's husband is going to go over and lock it up. I gave him my keys. Gretchen Tilbury said that Ed isn't supposed to go back for anything, not even his checkbook or a change of underwear. If there's stuff he needs, he gives a list and his house key to a policeman, and the policeman goes to get it. I suppose he'll go to Fresh Harbor. There's plenty of housing there for lab employees. These little cottages, they're actually sort of cute. The brief flash of fire he'd heard in her voice was long gone. Helen now sounded depressed, forlorn, and very, very tired. "Helen, I'm delighted that you called, and relieved. I won't kid you about that. Now get some sleep." "What about you, Ralph?" she asked unexpectedly. "Are you getting any sleep these days?" The switch in focus startled him into an honesty he might not otherwise have managed. "Some, but maybe not as much as I need. Probably not as much as I need." "Well, take care of yourself. You were very brave today, like a knight in a story about King Arthur. But I think even Sir Lancelot had to fall out every now and then." He was touched by this, and also amused. A momentary picture, very vivid, arose in his mind. Ralph Roberts, dressed in armor and mounted on a snow-white steed, while Bill McGovern, his faithful squire, rode behind him on his pony, dressed in a leather jerkin and his snappy Panama hat. "Thank you, dear," he said. "I think that's the sweetest thing anyone said to me since Lyndon Johnson was president. Have the best night you can, okay?" "Okay. You too." She hung up. Ralph stood looking at the phone thoughtfully for a moment or two, then put it back in its cradle. Perhaps he would have a good night. After everything that had happened today, he certainly deserved one. For the time being, he thought he might go downstairs, sit on the porch, watch the sun go down, and let later take care of itself. McGovern was back, slouched in his favorite chair on the porch. He was looking at something up the street and didn't immediately turn when his upstairs neighbor stepped outside. Ralph followed his gaze and saw a blue step van parked at the curb half a block up Harris Avenue, on the Red Apple side of the street. Derry Medical Services was printed across the rear doors in large white letters. "Hi, Bill," Ralph said, and dropped into his own chair. The rocker where Lois Chass always sat when she came over stood between them. A little twilight breeze had sprung up, delightfully cool after the heat of the afternoon, and the empty rocker moved lazily back and forth at its whim. "Hi," McGovern said, glancing over at Ralph. He started to look away, then did a double take. "Man, you better start pinning up the bags under your eyes. You're going to be stepping on them pretty soon if you don't." Ralph thought this was supposed to come out sounding like one of the caustic little bon mots for which McGovern was famous along the street. But the look in his eyes was one of genuine concern. "It's been a bitch of a day," he said. He told McGovern about Helen's call, editing out the things he thought she might be uncomfortable with McGovern knowing. Bill had never been one of her favorite people. "Glad she's okay," McGovern said. "I'll tell you something, Ralph. You impressed me today, marching up the street that way like Gary Cooper in High Noon. Maybe it was insane, but it was also pretty cool." He paused. "To tell the truth, I was a little in awe of you." This was the second time in 15 minutes that someone had come close to calling Ralph a hero. It made him uncomfortable. "I was too mad at him to realize how dumb I was being until later. Where you been, Bill? I tried to call you a little while ago." "I took a walk out to the extension," McGovern said. "Trying to cool my engine off a little, I guess. I felt headachy and sick to my stomach ever since Johnny Lydecker and that other one took Ed away." Ralph nodded. "Me too." "Really?" McGovern looked surprised and a little skeptical. "Really?" Ralph said with a faint smile. "Anyway, Faye Chapin was out at the picnic area where those old lags usually hang out during the hot weather, and he coaxed me into a game of chess. What a piece of work that guy is, Ralph. He thinks he's the reincarnation of Ruy Lopez, but he plays chess more like Soupy Sales, and he never shuts up." "Faye's all right, though," Ralph said quietly. McGovern seemed not to have heard him. And that creepy Dorrance Marsteller was out there, he went on. If we're old, he's a fossil. He just stands there by the fence between the picnic area and the airport with a book of poetry in his hands, watching the planes take off and land. Does he really read those books he carries around, do you think? Or are they just props? Good question, Ralph said. But he was thinking about the word McGovern had used to describe Dorrance. Creepy. It wasn't one he would have used himself. But there could be no doubt that old Dor was one of life's originals. He wasn't senile. At least Ralph didn't think he was. It was more as if the few things he said were the product of a mind that was slightly skewed and perceptions that were slightly bent. He remembered that Dorrance had been there that day last summer when Ed ran into the guy in the pickup truck. At the time, he thought that Dorrance's arrival had added the final screwy touch to the festivities. And Dorrance had said something funny. Ralph tried to recall what it was and couldn't. McGovern was gazing back up the street, where a whistling young man in a gray coverall had just come out of the house in front of which the medical services step van was parked. This young man, looking all of 24, and as if he hadn't needed a single medical service in his entire life, was rolling a dolly with a long green tank strapped to it. "That's the empty," McGovern said. "You missed them taking in the full one." A second young man, also dressed in a coverall, stepped out through the front door of the small house, which combined yellow paint and deep pink trim in an unfortunate manner. He stood on the stoop for a moment, hand on the doorknob, apparently speaking to someone inside. Then he pulled the door shut and ran lithely down the walk. He was in time to help his colleague lift the dolly, with the tank still strapped to it, into the back of the van. "Oxygen?" Ralph asked. McGovern nodded. "For Mrs. Locker?" McGovern nodded again, watching as the medical services workers slammed the doors of the step van and then stood behind them, talking quietly in the fading light. "I went to grammar school and junior high with May Locker, way out in Cardville, home of the brave and land of the cows. There were only 5 of us in our graduating class. Back in those days, she was known as a hot ticket, and fellows like me were known as a wee bit lavender. In that amusingly antique era, gay was how you described your Christmas tree after it was decorated." Ralph looked down at his hands, uncomfortable and tongue-tied. Of course he knew that McGovern was a homosexual, had known it for years, but he had never spoken of it out loud until this evening. He wished Bill could have saved it for another day, preferably one when Ralph himself wasn't feeling as if most of his brains had been replaced with goose down. "That was about 1,000 years ago," McGovern said. "Who'd have thought we'd both wash up on the shores of Harris Avenue?" "It's emphysema she has, isn't that right?" "I think that's what I heard." "Yep. One of those diseases that keeps on giving. Getting old is certainly no job for sissies, is it?" "No, it's not," Ralph said. And then his mind brought the truth of it home with sudden force. It was Carolyn he thought of, and the terror he had felt when he came squelching into the apartment in his soaked Converse sneakers, and had seen her lying half in and half out of the kitchen, exactly where he had stood during most of his conversation with Helen, in fact. Facing Ed Deepnow had been nothing compared to the terror he had felt at that moment, when he had been sure Carolyn was dead. "I can remember when they just brought May oxygen once every 2 weeks or so," McGovern said. "Now they come every Tuesday and Thursday evening, like clockwork. I go over and see her when I can. Sometimes I read to her the most boring women's magazine bullshit you can imagine. And sometimes we just sit and talk. She says it feels as if her lungs are filling up with seaweed. It won't be long now. They'll come one day, and instead of loading an empty oxy tank into the back of that wagon, they'll load May in. They'll take her off to Derry Home, and that'll be the end." "Was it cigarettes?" Ralph asked. McGovern favored him with a look so alien to that lean, mild face that it took Ralph several moments to realize it was contempt. "May Perrault never smoked a cigarette in her whole life. What she's paying off is 20 years in the dye house at a mill in Carina, and another 20 working the picker at a mill in Newport. It's cotton, wool, and nylon she's trying to breathe through, not seaweed. The two young men from Derry Medical Services got into their van and drove away. Maine's the northeastern anchor of Appalachia, Ralph. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's true. And May's dying of an Appalachian disease. The doctors call it textile lung. That's a shame. I guess she means a lot to you. McGovern laughed ruefully. Nah, I visit her because she happens to be the last visible piece of my misspent youth. Sometimes I read to her, and I always manage to get down one or two of her dry old oatmeal cookies. But that's about as far as it goes. My concern is safely selfish, I assure you. Safely selfish, Ralph thought. What a really odd phrase. What a really McGovern phrase. Never mind May, McGovern said. The question on the lips of Americans everywhere is what we're going to do about you, Ralph. The whiskey didn't work, did it? No, Ralph said. I'm afraid it didn't. To make a particularly apropos pun, did you give it a fair shot? Ralph nodded. Well, you have to do something about the bags under your eyes, or you'll never land the lovely Lois. McGovern studied Ralph's facial response to this and sighed. Not that funny, huh? Nope. It's been a long day. Sorry. It's okay. They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching the comings and goings on their part of Harris Avenue. Three little girls were playing hopscotch in the Red Apples parking lot across the street. Mrs. Perrine stood nearby, straight as a sentry, watching them. A boy with his Red Sox cap turned around backward went past, bopping to the beat of his Walkman headset. Two kids were tossing a frisbee back and forth in front of Lois's house. A dog barked. Somewhere a woman was yelling for Sam to get his sister and come inside. It was just the usual street life serenade, no more and no less. But to Ralph it all seemed strangely false. He supposed it was because he'd gotten so used to seeing Harris Avenue empty lately. He turned to McGovern and said, "You know what was just about the first thing I thought of when I saw you in the Red Apple parking lot this afternoon? In spite of everything else that was going on?" McGovern shook his head. "I wondered where the hell your hat was. The Panama. You looked very strange to me without it. Naked almost. So come clean. Where did you stash the lid, son?" McGovern touched the top of his head, where the remaining strands of his baby fine white hair were combed carefully left to right across his pink skull. "I don't know," he said. "I missed it this morning. I almost always remember to drop it on the table by the front door when I come in. But it's not there. I suppose I put it down somewhere else this time, and the exact locale has slipped my mind for the nonce. Give me another few years, and I'll be wandering around in my underwear because I can't remember where I left my pants. All part of the wonderful aging experience. Right, Ralph?" Ralph nodded and smiled, thinking to himself that of all the elderly people he knew, and he knew at least three dozen on a casual walk in the park, "Hi, how you doing?" basis, Bill McGovern bitched the most about getting on in years. He seemed to regard his vanished youth and recently departed middle age as a general would regard a couple of soldiers who desert on the eve of a big battle. He wasn't about to say such a thing, however. Everyone had their little eccentricities. Being theatrically morbid about growing old was simply one of McGovern's. "Did I say something funny?" McGovern asked. "Pardon?" "You were smiling, so I thought I must have said something funny." He sounded a bit touchy, especially for a man so fond of ribbing his upstairs neighbor about the pretty widow down the street. But Ralph reminded himself it had been a long day for McGovern, too. "I wasn't thinking about you at all," Ralph said. "I was thinking about how Carolyn used to say practically the same thing, that getting old was like getting a bad dessert at the end of a really fine meal." This was at least half a lie. Carolyn had made the metaphor, but she had used it to describe the brain tumor that was killing her, not her life as a senior citizen. She hadn't been all that senior anyway, just 64 when she died. And until the last 6 or 8 weeks of her life, she'd claimed to feel only half of that on most days. Across the street, the three girls who had been playing hopscotch approached the curb, looked both ways for traffic, then joined hands and ran across the street, laughing. For just a moment, they looked to him as if they were surrounded by a gray glow, a nimbus that illuminated their cheeks and brows and laughing eyes like some strange, clarifying St. Elmo's fire. A little frightened, Ralph squeezed his eyes shut and then popped them open again. The gray envelope he'd imagined around the trio of girls was gone, which was a relief. But he had to get some sleep soon. He had to. Ralph? McGovern's voice seemed to be coming from the far end of the porch, although he hadn't moved. You all right? Sure, Ralph said. Thinking about Ed and Helen, that's all. Did you have any idea how screwy he was getting, Bill? McGovern shook his head decisively. None whatsoever, he said. And although I saw bruises on Helen from time to time, I always believed her stories about them. I don't like to think of myself as a tremendously gullible person, but I may have to reassess my thinking on that score. What do you think will happen with him? Any predictions? McGovern sighed and touched the top of his head with his fingertips, feeling for the missing Panama without realizing it. You know me, Ralph. I'm a cynic from a long line of them. I think it's very rare for ordinary human conflicts to resolve themselves the way they do on TV. In reality, they just keep coming back, turning in diminishing circles until they finally disappear. Except disappearing isn't really what they do. They dry up like mud puddles in the sun. McGovern paused and then added, and most of them leave the same scummy residue behind. Jesus, Ralph said, that is cynical. McGovern shrugged. Most retired teachers are cynical, Ralph. We see them come in so young and so strong, so convinced that it's going to be different for them, and we see them make their messes and then paddle around in them, just as their parents and grandparents did. What I think is that Helen will go back to him, and Ed will do okay for a while, and then he'll beat her up again, and she'll leave again. It's like one of those sappy country western songs they have on the juke out at Nicky's lunch, and some people have to listen to that song a long, long time before they decide they don't want to hear it anymore. Helen's a bright young woman, though. I think one more verse is all she'll need. One more verse might be all she'll ever get, Ralph said quietly. We're not talking about some drunk husband coming home on Friday night and beating his wife up because he lost his paycheck in a poker game, and she dared to bitch about it. I know, McGovern said, but you asked for my opinion, and I gave it to you. I think Helen's going to need one more verse on the jukebox before she can bring herself to call it off. And even then, they're apt to keep on bumping up against each other. It's still a pretty small town. He paused, squinting down the street. Oh, look, he said, hoisting his left brow. Our Lois, she walks in beauty like the night. Ralph gave him an impatient look, which McGovern either did not see or pretended not to. He got up, once again touching the tips of his fingers to the place where the Panama wasn't, and then went down the steps to meet her on the walk. Lois, McGovern cried, dropping on one knee before her and extending his hands theatrically. Would that our lives might be united by the starry bonds of love. Wed your fate to mine, and let me whirl you away to climes various in the golden car of my affections. Gee, are you talking about a honeymoon or a one-night stand? Lois asked, smiling uncertainly. Ralph poked McGovern in the back. Get up, fool, he said, and took the small bag Lois was carrying. He looked inside and saw three cans of beer. McGovern got to his feet. Sorry, Lois, he said. It was a combination of summer twilight and your beauty. I plead temporary insanity, in other words. Lois smiled at him, then turned to Ralph. I just heard what happened, she said, and I hurried over as fast as I could. I was in Ludlow all afternoon, playing nickel-dime poker with the girls. Ralph didn't have to look at McGovern to know that his left eyebrow, the one that said, poker with the girls, how wonderfully, typically, perfectly our Lois, would be hoisted to its maximum altitude. Is Helen all right? Yes, Ralph said. Well, maybe not exactly all right. They're keeping her in the hospital overnight. but she's not in any danger. And the baby? Fine. Staying with a friend of Helen's. Well, come on up on the porch, you two, and tell me all about it. She linked one arm through McGovern's, the other through Ralph's, and led them back up the walk. They mounted the porch steps that way, like two elderly musketeers, with a woman whose affections they had vied for in the days of their youth held safely between them. And as Lois sat down in her rocking chair, the street lights went on along Harris Avenue, glimmering in the dusk like a double rope of pearls. Ralph fell asleep that night, bare instants after his head hit the pillow, and came wide awake again at 3:30 a.m. on Friday morning. He knew immediately there was no question of going back to sleep. He might as well proceed directly to the wing chair in the living room. He lay there a moment longer anyway, looking up into the dark and trying to catch the tale of the dream he'd been having. He couldn't do it. He could only remember that Ed had been in it, and Helen, and Rosalie, the dog he sometimes saw limping up or down Harris Avenue before Pat the paperboy showed up. Dorrance was in it, too. Dorrance Marstella. Don't forget him. And as if a key had turned in a lock, Ralph suddenly remembered the strange thing Dorrance had said during the confrontation between Ed and the heavyset man last year. The thing Ralph hadn't been able to remember earlier this evening when McGovern brought the old man's name up. He'd been holding Ed back, trying to keep him pinned against the bent hood of his car long enough for reason to reassert itself. And Dorrance had said, "I wouldn't," that Ralph ought to stop touching him. "He said he couldn't see my hands anymore," Ralph muttered, swinging his feet out of the bed. That was it. He sat where he was for a little while, head down, hair frizzed up wildly in back, his fingers laced loosely together between his thighs. At last he stepped into his slippers and shuffled into the living room. It was time to start waiting for the sun to come up. Although cynics always sounded more plausible than the cockeyed optimists of the world, Ralph's experience had been that they were wrong at least as much of the time, if not more. And he was delighted to find that McGovern was wrong about Helen Deepnow. In her case, a single verse of the beaten-up, broken-hearted blues seemed to have been enough. On Wednesday of the following week, just as Ralph was deciding he'd better track down the woman Helen had spoken with in the hospital, Tilbury. Her name had been Gretchen Tilbury, and tried to make sure Helen was okay. He received a letter from her. The return address was simple, just Helen and Nat, High Ridge. But it was enough to relieve Ralph's mind considerably. He sat down in his chair on the porch, tore the end off the envelope, and shook out two sheets of lined paper crammed with Helen's back-slanted handwriting. "Dear Ralph," the letter began, "I suppose by now you must be thinking I decided to be mad at you after all. But I really didn't. It's just that we're supposed to stay out of contact with everyone, by phone and letter, for the first few days. Rules of the house. I like this place very much, and so does Nat." Of course she does. There are at least six kids her age to crawl around with. "As for me, I'm finding more women who know what I've been through than I ever would have believed. I mean, you see the TV shows. Oprah talks with women who love men who use them for punching bags. But when it happens to you, you can't help feeling that it's happening in a way it's never happened to anyone else, in a way that's brand new to the world. The relief of knowing that's not true is the best thing that's happened to me in a long, long time." She talked about the chores to which she had been assigned, working in the garden, helping to repaint an equipment shed, washing the storm windows with vinegar and water, and about Nat's adventures in learning to walk. The rest of the letter was about what had happened and what she intended to do about it. And it was here that Ralph, for the first time, really sensed the emotional turmoil Helen must be feeling, her worries about the future, and counterbalancing these things, a formidable determination to do what was right for Nat, and for her, too. Helen seemed to be just discovering that she also had a right to the right thing. Ralph was happy she had found out, but sad when he thought of all the dark times she must have trudged through in order to reach that simple insight. "I'm going to divorce him," she wrote. "Part of my mind, it sounds like my mother when it talks, just about howls when I put it that bluntly, but I'm tired of fooling myself about my situation. There's a lot of therapy out here, the kind of thing where people sit around in a circle and use up about 4 boxes of Kleenex in the course of an hour. But it all seems to come back to seeing things plain. In my case, the plain fact is that the man I married has been replaced by a dangerous paranoid. That he can sometimes be loving and sweet isn't the point, but a distraction. I need to remember that the man who used to bring me hand-picked flowers now sometimes sits on the porch and talks to someone who isn't there. A man he calls the little bald doctor. Isn't that a beaut? I think I have an idea of how all this started, Ralph. And when I see you, I'll tell you, if you really want to hear. I should be back at the house on Harris Avenue, for a while anyway, by mid-September, if only to look for a job. But no more about that now. The whole subject scares me to death. I had a note from Ed, just a paragraph, but a great relief just the same, saying that he was staying at one of the cottages at the Hawking Labs compound in Fresh Harbor, and that he would honor the non-contact clause in the bail agreement. He said he was sorry for everything, but I didn't get any real sense of it, if he was. It's not that I was expecting tear stains on the letter, or a package with his ear in it, but I don't know. It was as if he wasn't really apologizing at all, but just getting on the record. Does that make sense? He also included a $750 check, which seems to indicate he understands his responsibilities. That's good, but I think I'd have been happier to hear he was getting help with his mental problems. That should be his sentence, you know. 18 months at hard therapy. I said that in group, and several people laughed as if they thought I was joking. I wasn't. Sometimes I get these scary pictures in my head when I try to think of the future. I see us standing in line at Manor for a free meal, or me walking into the Third Street homeless shelter with Nat in my arms, wrapped in a blanket. When I think of that stuff, I start to shake. Sometimes I cry. I know it's stupid. I've got a graduate degree in library science, for God's sake, but I can't help it. And do you know what I hold on to when those bad pictures come? What you said after you took me behind the counter in the Red Apple and sat me down. You told me that I had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, and I was going to get through this. I know I have one friend, at least. One very true friend. The letter was signed, Love, Helen. Ralph wiped tears from the corners of his eyes. He cried at the drop of a hat just lately, it seemed. It probably came from being so goddamn tired. And read the P.S. she had crammed in at the bottom of the sheet and up the right-hand margin. I'd love to have you come and visit, but men are off limits out here for reasons I'm sure you will understand. They even want us to be quiet about the exact location. H. Ralph sat for a minute or two with Helen's letter in his lap, looking out over Harris Avenue. It was the tag end of August now, still summer, but the leaves of the poplars had begun to gleam silver when the wind stroked them, and there was the first touch of coolness in the air. The sign in the window of the Red Apple said, "School supplies of all types. Check here first." And somewhere out by the Newport town line, in some big old farmhouse where battered women went to try and start putting their lives back together, Helen Deepnow was washing storm windows, getting them ready for another long winter. He slid the letter carefully back into its envelope, trying to remember how long Ed and Helen had been married. 7 or 8 years, he thought. Carolyn would have known for sure. How much courage does it take to fire up your tractor and plow under a crop you spent 7 or 8 years growing, he asked himself. How much courage to go on and do that after you've spent all that time finding out how to prepare the soil and when to plant and how much to water and when to reap. How much to just say, I have to quit these peas. Peas are no good for me. I better try corn or beans. A lot, he said, wiping at the corners of his eyes again. A damn lot, that's what I think. Suddenly he wanted very badly to see Helen again, to repeat what she so well remembered hearing and what he could barely remember saying. "You'll be okay. You'll get through this. You have a lot of friends in the neighborhood." "Take it to the bank," Ralph said. Hearing from Helen seemed to have taken a great weight off his shoulders. He got up, put her letter in his back pocket, and started up Harris Avenue toward the picnic area on the extension. If he was lucky, he could find Faye Chapin or Don Veazey and play a little chess.